Ooh, lolled a pink plaster of Paris gnome, with rosy cheeks and a peaked red cap. Baby Kuchma spent her afternoons in her garden, in sari and gumboots. She wielded an enormous pair of head shears in her bright orange gardening gloves. Like a lion tamer, she tamed twisting vines and nurtured bristling cacti. She limited bonsai plants and pampered rare orchids. She waged war on the weather. She tried to grow edelweiss and Chinese guava. Every night, she creamed her feet with real cream and pushed back the cuticles on her toenails. Recently, after enduring more than half a century of relentless, pernickety attention, the ornamental garden had been abandoned. Left to its own devices, it had grown knotted and wild, like a circus whose animals had forgotten their tricks. The weed that people call communist pacha, because it flourished in Kerala like communism, smothered the more exotic plants. Only the vines kept growing, like toenails on a corpse. They reached through the nostrils of the pink plaster gnomes and blossomed in their hollow heads, giving them an expression half surprised, half sneeze coming. The reason for this sudden, unceremonious dumping was a new love. Baby Kuchma had installed a dish antenna on the roof of the Imanam house. She presided over the world in her drawing room on satellite TV. The impossible excitement that this engendered in Baby Kuchma wasn't hard to understand. It wasn't something that happened gradually. It happened overnight. Blondes, wars, famines, football, sex, music, coup d'etat, they all arrived on the same train. They unpacked together. They stayed at the same hotel. And in Imanam, where once the loudest sound had been a musical bus horn, now whole wars, famines, picturesque massacres, and Bill Clinton could be summoned up like servants. And so while her ornamental garden wilted and died, Baby Kuchma followed American NBA League games, one-day cricket, and all the Grand Slam tennis tournaments. On weekdays, she watched The Bold and the Beautiful and Santa Barbara, where brittle blondes with lipstick and hairstyles rigid with spray seduced androids and defended their sexual empires. Baby Kuchma loved their shiny clothes and the smart, bitchy repartee. During the day, disconnected snatches of it came back to her and made her chuckle. Kuchmaria, the cook, still wore the thick gold earrings that had disfigured her earlobes forever. She enjoyed the WWF Wrestling Mania shows, where Hulk Hogan and Mr. Perfect, whose necks were wider than their heads, wore spangled lycra leggings and beat each other up brutally. Kuchumaria's laugh had that slightly cruel ring to it that young children's sometimes have. All day they sat in the drawing room. Baby Kuchma on the long-armed planter's chair, or the chaise longue, depending on the condition of her feet. Kuchmaria next to her on the floor, channel surfing when she could, locked together in a noisy television silence. One's hair snow-white, the other's dyed coal-black. They entered all the contests, availed themselves of all the discounts that were advertised, and had, on two occasions, won a T-shirt and a thermos flask that Baby Kuchma kept locked away in her cupboard. Baby Kuchma loved the Imanam house and cherished the furniture that she had inherited by outliving everybody else. Mamachi's violin and violin stand, the uti cupboards, the plastic basket chairs, the deli beds, the dressing table from Vienna with cracked ivory knobs, the rosewood dining table that Velita made. She was frightened by the BBC famines and television wars that she encountered while she channel-surfed. Her old fears of the revolution and the Marxist-Leninist menace had been rekindled by new television worries about the growing numbers of desperate and dispossessed people. She viewed ethnic cleansing, famine, and genocide as direct threats to her furniture. She kept her doors and windows locked unless she was using them. She used her windows for specific purposes, for A breath of fresh air. To pay for the milk. To let out a trapped wasp, which Cochimaria was made to chase around the house with a towel. She even locked her sad, paint-flaking fridge, where she kept her week supply of cream buns that Cochimaria brought her from Best Bakery in Corte. And the 2 bottles of rice water that she drank instead of ordinary water. On the shelf below the baffle tray, she kept what was left of Mamachi's willow pattern dinner service. She put the dozen or so bottles of insulin that Rahel brought her in the cheese and butter compartment. She suspected that these days, even the innocent and the round-eyed could be crockery crooks, or cream bun cravers, or thieving diabetics cruising Imanum for imported insulin. She didn't even trust the twins. She deemed them capable of anything. Anything at all. They might even steal their present back, she thought, and realized with a pang how quickly she had reverted to thinking of them as though they were a single unit once again. After all those years. Determined not to let the past creep up on her, she altered her thought at once. She might steal her present back. She looked at Rahel, standing at the dining table, and noticed the same eerie stealth, the ability to keep very still and very quiet that Esther seemed to have mastered. Baby Kuchma was a little intimidated by Rahel's quietness. So, she said, her voice shrill, faltering, what are your plans? How long will you be staying? Have you decided? Rahel tried to say something. It came out jagged, like a piece of tin. She walked to the window and opened it. For a breath of fresh air. Shut it when you've finished with it, Baby Kuchma said, and closed her face like a cupboard. You couldn't see the river from the window anymore. You could, until Mamachi had had the back veranda closed in with Imanum's first sliding folding door. The oil portraits of Reverend E. John Ipe and Eliuti Amachi, Esther and Rahel's great-grandparents, were taken down from the back veranda and put up in the front one. They hung there now, the little blessed one and his wife, on either side of the stuffed, mounted bison head. Reverend Ipe smiled his confident ancestor smile out across the road instead of the river. Eliuti Amachi looked more hesitant, as though she would have liked to turn around but couldn't. Perhaps it wasn't as easy for her to abandon the river. With her eyes, she looked in the direction that her husband looked. With her heart, she looked away. Her heavy, dull, gold kunuki earrings, tokens of the little blessed one's goodness, had stretched her earlobes and hung all the way down to her shoulders. Through the holes in her ears, you could see the hot river and the dark trees that bent into it, and the fishermen in their boats, and the fish. Though you couldn't see the river from the house anymore, like a seashell always has a sea sense, the Imanum house still had a river sense. A rushing, rolling, fish-swimming sense. From the dining room window where she stood, with the wind in her hair, Rahel could see the rain drum down on the rusted tin roof of what used to be their grandmother's pickle factory. Paradise pickles and preserves. It lay between the house and the river. They used to make pickles, squashes, jams, curry powders, and canned pineapples. And banana jam, illegally, after the FPO, Food Products Organization, banned it because, according to their specifications, it was neither jam nor jelly. Too thin for jelly and too thick for jam. An ambiguous, unclassifiable consistency, they said. As per their books. Looking back now to Rahel, it seemed as though this difficulty that their family had with classification ran much deeper than the jam-jelly question. Perhaps Amu, Esther, and she were the worst transgressors. But it wasn't just them. It was the others, too. They all broke the rules. They all crossed into forbidden territory. They all tampered with the laws that lay down who should be loved and how. And how much. The laws that make grandmothers grandmothers, uncles uncles, mothers mothers, cousins cousins, jam jam and jelly jelly. It was a time when uncles became fathers, mothers lovers, and cousins died and had funerals. It was a time when the unthinkable became thinkable, and the impossible really happened. Even before Sophie Moll's funeral, the police found Verta. His arms had goosebumps where the handcuffs touched his skin. Cold handcuffs with a sour metal smell. Like steel bus rails and the smell of the bus conductor's hands from holding them. After it was all over, Baby Kuchma said, "As ye sow, so shall ye reap." As though she had nothing to do with the sowing and the reaping. She returned on her small feet to her cross-stitch embroidery. Her little toes never touched the floor. It was her idea that Esther be returned. Margaret Kochma's grief and bitterness at her daughter's death coiled inside her like an angry spring. She said nothing but slapped Esther whenever she could in the days she was there, before she returned to England. Rahel watched Amu pack Esther's little trunk. "Maybe they're right," Amu's whisper said. "Maybe a boy does need a baba." Rahel saw that her eyes were redly dead. They consulted a twin expert in Hyderabad. She wrote back to say that it was not advisable to separate monozygotic twins, but that two-egg twins were no different from ordinary siblings, and that while they would certainly suffer the natural distress that children from broken homes underwent, it would be nothing more than that. Nothing out of the ordinary. And so Esther was returned, in a train with his tin trunk and his beige and pointy shoes rolled into his khaki holdall. First class, overnight on the Madras mail to Madras, and then with a friend of their father's from Madras to Calcutta. He had a tiffin carrier with tomato sandwiches, and an eagle flask with an eagle. He had terrible pictures in his head. Rain, rushing inky water, and a smell, sick sweet, like old roses on a breeze. But worst of all, he carried inside him the memory of a young man with an old man's mouth, the memory of a swollen face and a smashed, upside-down smile, of a spreading pool of clear liquid with a bare bulb reflected in it. Of a bloodshot eye that had opened, wandered, and then fixed its gaze on him, Esther. And what had Esther done? He had looked into that beloved face and said, "Yes." Yes, it was him. The word Esther's octopus couldn't get at, yes. Hoovering didn't seem to help. It was lodged there deep inside some fold or furrow, like a mango hair between molars. That couldn't be worried loose. In a purely practical sense, it would probably be correct to say that it all began when Sophie Moll came to Imanam. Perhaps it's true that things can change in a day, that a few dozen hours can affect the outcome of whole lifetimes, and that when they do, those few dozen hours, like the salvaged remains of a burned house, the charred clock, the singed photograph, the scorched furniture, must be resurrected from the ruins and examined, preserved, accounted for. Little events, ordinary things, smashed and reconstituted, imbued with new meaning. Suddenly they become the bleached bones of a story. Still, to say that it all began when Sophie Moll came to Imanam is only one way of looking at it. Equally, it could be argued that it actually began thousands of years ago, long before the Marxists came, before the British took Malabar, before the Dutch ascendancy, before Vasco da Gama arrived, before the Zamorin's conquest of Calicut, before three purple-robed Syrian bishops murdered by the Portuguese were found floating in the sea with coiled sea serpents riding on their chests and oysters knotted in their tangled beards. It could be argued that it began long before Christianity arrived in a boat and seeped into Kerala like tea from a teabag. That it really began in the days when the love laws were made, the laws that lay down Who should be loved and how? And how much? However, for practical purposes, in a hopelessly practical world. Chapter 2. Papachi's Moth. It was a sky blue day in December 69, the 19 silent. It was the kind of time in the life of a family when something happens to nudge its hidden morality from its resting place and make it bubble to the surface and float for a while, in clear view for everyone to see. A sky blue Plymouth, with the sun in its tail fins, sped past young rice fields and old rubber trees on its way to Cochin. Further east, in a small country with similar landscape, jungles, rivers, rice fields, communists, enough bombs were being dropped to cover all of it in 6 inches of steel. Here, however, it was peacetime, and the family in the Plymouth traveled without fear or foreboding. The Plymouth used to belong to Papachi, Rahel and Esther's grandfather. Now that he was dead, it belonged to Mamachi, their grandmother, and Rahel and Esther were on their way to Cochin to see The Sound of Music for the third time. They knew all the songs. After that, they were all going to stay at Hotel Sea Queen with the old food smell. Bookings had been made. Early next morning, they would go to Cochin Airport to pick up Charco's ex-wife, their English aunt, Margaret Kochima, and their cousin, Sophie Moore, who were coming from London to spend Christmas at Imanam. Earlier that year, Margaret Kochima's second husband, Joe, had been killed in a car accident. When Charco heard about the accident, he invited them to Imanam. He said that he couldn't bear to think of them spending a lonely, desolate Christmas in England, in a house full of memories. Amu said that Charco had never stopped loving Margaret Kochima. Mamachi disagreed. She liked to believe that he had never loved her in the first place. Rahel and Esther had never met Sophie Moll. They'd heard a lot about her, though, that last week, from Baby Kochima, from Kochimaria, and even Mamachi. None of them had met her either, but they all behaved as though they already knew her. It had been the "What will Sophie Moll think?" week. That whole week, Baby Kochima eavesdropped relentlessly on the twins' private conversations, and whenever she caught them speaking in Malayalam, she levied a small fine, which was deducted at source, from their pocket money. She made them write lines, impositions, she called them. "I will always speak in English, I will always speak in English," 100 times each. When they were done, she scored them out with her red pen to make sure that all lines were not recycled for new punishments. She had made them practice an English car song for the way back. They had to form the words properly and be particularly careful about their pronunciation. Pronunciation. Ridge. Oice in the law, ord, or, always. And again I say, rejoice. 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 And again I say, rejoice. Esther's full name was Esther Panyako. Rahel's was Rahel. For the time being, they had no surname because Amu was considering reverting to her maiden name, though she said that choosing between her husband's name and her father's name didn't give a woman much of a choice. Esther was wearing his beige and pointy shoes and his Elvis puff, his special outing puff. His favorite Elvis song was "Party." "Some people like to rock, some people like to roll," he would croon when nobody was watching, strumming a badminton racket, curling his lip like Elvis. "But moon and Anna groon and gonna satisfy my soul, let's have a party." Esther had slanting, sleepy eyes, and his new front teeth were still uneven on the ends. Rahel's new teeth were waiting inside her gums like words in a pen. It puzzled everybody that an 18-minute age difference could cause such a discrepancy in front tooth timing. Most of Rahel's hair sat on top of her head like a fountain. It was held together by a love in Tokyo, 2 beads on a rubber band, nothing to do with love or Tokyo. In Kerala, Love in Tokyos have withstood the test of time, and even today, if you were to ask for one at any respectable A1 lady store, that's what you'd get. 2 beads on a rubber band. Rahel's toy wristwatch had the time painted on it, 10 to 2. One of her ambitions was to own a watch on which she could change the time whenever she wanted to, which, according to her, was what time was meant for in the first place. Her yellow-rimmed red plastic sunglasses made the world look red. Amu said that they were bad for her eyes and had advised her to wear them as seldom as possible. Her airport frock was in Amu's suitcase. It had special matching knickers. Chako was driving. He was 4 years older than Amu. Rahel and Esther couldn't call him Chachan because when they did, he called them Chetan and Chirti. If they called him Ammavan, he called them Appoy and Ammai. If they called him Uncle, he called them Auntie, which was embarrassing in public. So they called him Chako. Chako's room was stacked from floor to ceiling with books. He had read them all and quoted long passages from them for no apparent reason, or at least none that anyone else could fathom. For instance, that morning, as they drove out through the gate, shouting their goodbyes to Mamachi in the veranda, Chako suddenly said, "Gatsby turned out all right at the end." It is what preyed on Gatsby, what foul dust floated in the wake of his dreams that temporarily closed out my interest in the abortive sorrows and short-winded elations of men. Everyone was so used to it that they didn't bother to nudge each other or exchange glances. Chako had been a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford and was permitted excesses and eccentricities nobody else was. He claimed to be writing a family biography that the family would have to pay him not to publish. Amu said that there was only one person in the family who was a fit candidate for biographical blackmail, and that was Chako himself. Of course, that was then, before the terror. In the Plymouth, Amu was sitting in front, next to Chako. She was 27 that year. And in the pit of her stomach, she carried the cold knowledge that for her, life had been lived. She had had one chance. She made a mistake. She married the wrong man. Amu finished her schooling the same year that her father retired from his job in Delhi and moved to Imanam. Papachi insisted that a college education was an unnecessary expense for a girl, so Amu had no choice but to leave Delhi and move with them. There was very little for a young girl to do in Imanam other than to wait for marriage proposals while she helped her mother with the housework. Since her father did not have enough money to raise a suitable dowry, no proposals came Amu's way. 2 years went by. Her 18th birthday came and went, unnoticed, or at least unremarked upon by her parents. Amu grew desperate. All day she dreamed of escaping from Imanam and the clutches of her ill-tempered father and bitter, long-suffering mother. She hatched several wretched little plans. Eventually one worked. Papachi agreed to let her spend the summer with a distant aunt who lived in Calcutta. There, at someone else's wedding reception, Amu met her future husband. He was on vacation from his job in Assam, where he worked as an assistant manager of a tea estate. His family were once wealthy zamindars who had migrated to Calcutta from East Bengal after partition. He was a small man, but well-built, pleasant-looking. He wore old-fashioned spectacles that made him look earnest and completely belied his easygoing charm and juvenile but totally disarming sense of humor. He was 25 and had already been working on the tea estates for 6 years. He hadn't been to college, which accounted for his schoolboy humor. He proposed to Amu 5 days after they first met. Amu didn't pretend to be in love with him. She just weighed the odds and accepted. She thought that anything, anyone at all, would be better than returning to Imanam. She wrote to her parents, informing them of her decision. They didn't reply. Amu had an elaborate Calcutta wedding. Later, looking back on the day, Amu realized that the slightly feverish glitter in her bridegroom's eyes had not been love, or even excitement at the prospect of carnal bliss, but approximately 8 large pegs of whiskey. Straight. Neat. Amu's father-in-law was chairman of the railway board and had a boxing blue from Cambridge. He was the secretary of the BABA, the Bengal Amateur Boxing Association. He gave the young couple a custom-painted powder-pink Fiat as a present, which after the wedding he drove off in himself, with all the jewelry and most of the other presents that they had been given. He died before the twins were born, on the operating table, while his gallbladder was being removed. His cremation was attended by all the boxers in Bengal, a congregation of mourners with lantern jaws and broken noses. When Amu and her husband moved to Assam, Amu, beautiful, young, and cheeky, became the toast of the Planters Club. She wore backless blouses with her saris and carried a silver lamé purse on a chain. She smoked long cigarettes in a silver cigarette holder and learned to blow perfect smoke rings. Her husband turned out to be not just a heavy drinker, but a full-blown alcoholic with all of an alcoholic's deviousness and tragic charm. There were things about him that Amu never understood. Long after she left him, she never stopped wondering why he lied so outrageously when he didn't need to, particularly when he didn't need to. In a conversation with friends, he would talk about how much he loved smoked salmon when Amu knew he hated it. Or he would come home from the club and tell Amu that he saw Meet Me in St. Louis when they'd actually screened The Bronze Buckaroo. When she confronted him about these things, he never explained or apologized. He just giggled, exasperating Amu to a degree she never thought herself capable of. Amu was 8 months pregnant when war broke out with China. It was October of 1962. Planters' wives and children were evacuated from Assam. Amu, too pregnant to travel, remained on the estate. In November, after a hair-raising bumpy bus ride to Shillong, amidst rumors of Chinese occupation and India's impending defeat, Esther and Rahel were born. By candlelight. In a hospital with the windows blacked out. They emerged without much fuss, within 18 minutes of each other. 2 little ones instead of 1 big one. Twin seals, slick with their mother's juices, wrinkled with the effort of being born. Amu checked them for deformities before she closed her eyes and slept. She counted 4 eyes, 4 ears, 2 mouths, 2 noses, 20 fingers, and 20 perfect toenails. She didn't notice the single Siamese soul. She was glad to have them. Their father, stretched out on a hard bench in the hospital corridor, was drunk. By the time the twins were 2 years old, their father's drinking, aggravated by the loneliness of Tea Estate life, had driven him into an alcoholic stupor. Whole days went by during which he just lay in bed and didn't go to work. Eventually, his English manager, Mr. Hollick, summoned him to his bungalow for a serious chat. Amu sat in the veranda of her home, waiting anxiously for her husband to return. She was sure the only reason that Hollick wanted to see him was to sack him. She was surprised when he returned, looking despondent, but not devastated. Mr. Hollick had proposed something, he told Amu, that he needed to discuss with her. He began a little diffidently, avoiding her gaze, but he gathered courage as he went along. Viewed practically, in the long run, it was a proposition that would benefit both of them, he said. In fact, all of them, if they considered the children's education. Mr. Hollick had been frank with his young assistant. He informed him of the complaints he had received from the labor as well as from the other assistant managers. "I'm afraid I have no option," he said, "but to ask for your resignation." He allowed the silence to take its toll. He allowed the pitiful man sitting across the table to begin to shake, to weep, Then Hollick spoke again. Well, actually there may be an option. Perhaps we could work something out. Think positive is what I always say. Count your blessings. Hollick paused to order a pot of black coffee. You're a very lucky man, you know. Wonderful family, beautiful children, such an attractive wife. He lit a cigarette and allowed the match to burn until he couldn't hold it anymore. An extremely attractive wife. The weeping stopped. Puzzled brown eyes looked into lurid, red-veined green ones. Over coffee, Mr. Hollick proposed that Baba go away for a while, for a holiday, to a clinic perhaps for treatment, for as long as it took him to get better. And for the period of time that he was away, Mr. Hollick suggested that Amu be sent to his bungalow to be looked after. Already there were a number of ragged, light-skinned children on the estate that Hollick had bequeathed on tea-pickers whom he fancied. This was his first incursion into management circles. Amu watched her husband's mouth move as it formed words. She said nothing. He grew uncomfortable and then infuriated by her silence. Suddenly he lunged at her, grabbed her hair, punched her, and then passed out from the effort. Amu took down the heaviest book she could find in the bookshelf, the Reader's Digest World Atlas, and hit him with it as hard as she could, on his head, his legs, his back and shoulders. When he regained consciousness, he was puzzled by his bruises. He apologized abjectly for the violence, but immediately began to badger her about helping with his transfer. This fell into a pattern, drunken violence followed by post-drunken badgering. Amu was repelled by the medicinal smell of stale alcohol that seeped through his skin and the dry, caked vomit that encrusted his mouth like a pie every morning. When his bouts of violence began to include the children and the war with Pakistan began, Amu left her husband and returned, unwelcomed, to her parents in Imanam, to everything that she had fled from only a few years ago. Except that now she had two young children, and no more dreams. Papachi would not believe her story, not because he thought well of her husband, but simply because he didn't believe that an Englishman, any Englishman, would covet another man's wife. Amu loved her children, of course. But their wide-eyed vulnerability and their willingness to love people who didn't really love them exasperated her and sometimes made her want to hurt them, just as an education, a protection. It was as though the window through which their father disappeared had been kept open for anyone to walk in and be welcomed. To Amu, her twins seemed like a pair of small, bewildered frogs, engrossed in each other's company, lolloping arm in arm down a highway full of hurtling traffic, entirely oblivious of what trucks can do to frogs. Amu watched over them fiercely. Her watchfulness stretched her, made her taut and tense. She was quick to reprimand her children, but even quicker to take offense on their behalf. For herself, she knew that there would be no more chances. There was only Imanam now. A front veranda and a back veranda. A hot river and a pickle factory. And in the background, the constant, high, whining mule of local disapproval. Within the first few months of her return to her parents' home, Amu quickly learned to recognize and despise the ugly face of sympathy. Old female relations with incipient beards and several wobbling chins made overnight trips to Imanam to commiserate with her about her divorce. They squeezed her knee and gloated. She fought off the urge to slap them or twiddle their nipples with a spanner, like Chaplin in modern times. When she looked at herself in her wedding photographs, Amu felt the woman that looked back at her was someone else, a foolish jeweled bride. Her silk, sunset-colored sari shot with gold. Rings on every finger, white dots of sandalwood paste over her arched eyebrows. Looking at herself like this, Amu's soft mouth would twist into a small, bitter smile at the memory. Not of the wedding itself, so much as the fact that she had permitted herself to be so painstakingly decorated before being led to the gallows. It seemed so absurd, so futile. Like polishing firewood. She went to the village goldsmith and had her heavy wedding ring melted down and made into a thin bangle with snake heads that she put away for Rahel. Amu knew that weddings were not something that could be avoided altogether, at least not practically speaking. But for the rest of her life, she advocated small weddings in ordinary clothes. It made them less ghoulish, she thought. Occasionally, when Amu listened to songs that she loved on the radio, something stirred inside her. A liquid ache spread under her skin, and she walked out of the world like a witch, to a better, happier place. On days like this, there was something restless and untamed about her, as though she had temporarily set aside the morality of motherhood and divorceehood. Even her walk changed from a safe mother walk to another wilder sort of walk. She wore flowers in her hair and carried magic secrets in her eyes. She spoke to no one. She spent hours on the riverbank with her little plastic transistor shaped like a tangerine. She smoked cigarettes and had midnight swims. What was it that gave Amu this unsafe edge, this air of unpredictability? It was what she had battling inside her, an unmixable mix. The infinite tenderness of motherhood and the reckless rage of a suicide bomber. It was this that grew inside her, and eventually led her to love by night, the man her children loved by day. To use by night the boat that her children used by day. The boat that Esther sat on, and Rahel found. On the days that the radio played Amu's songs, everyone was a little wary of her. They sensed somehow that she lived in the penumbral shadows between two worlds, just beyond the grasp of their power, that a woman that they had already damned now had little left to lose and could therefore be dangerous. So on the days that the radio played Amu's songs, people avoided her, made little loops around her because everybody agreed that it was best to just let her be. On other days, she had deep dimples when she smiled. She had a delicate, chiseled face, black eyebrows angled like a soaring seagull's wings, a small straight nose, and luminous nut-brown skin. On that sky-blue December day, her wild, curly hair had escaped in wisps in the car wind. Her shoulders in her sleeveless sari blouse shone as though they had been polished with a high-wax shoulder polish. Sometimes she was the most beautiful woman that Esther and Rahel had ever seen. And sometimes she wasn't. On the back seat of the Plymouth, between Esther and Rahel, sat baby Kochama, ex-nun and incumbent baby grandaunt. In the way that the unfortunate sometimes dislike the co-unfortunate, baby Kochama disliked the twins for she considered them doomed fatherless waifs. Worse still, they were half-Hindu hybrids whom no self-respecting Syrian Christian would ever marry. She was keen for them to realize that they, like herself, lived on sufferance in the Imanam house, their maternal grandmother's house, where they really had no right to be. Baby Kochama resented Amu because she saw her quarreling with a fate that she, Baby Kochama herself, felt she had graciously accepted. The fate of the wretched, manless woman. The sad, father mulliganless Baby Kochama. She had managed to persuade herself over the years that her unconsummated love for Father Mulligan had been entirely due to her restraint and her determination to do the right thing. She subscribed wholeheartedly to the commonly held view that a married daughter had no position in her parents' home. As for a divorced daughter, according to Baby Kachma, she had no position anywhere at all. And as for a divorced daughter from a love marriage, well, words could not describe Baby Kachma's outrage. As for a divorced daughter from an inter-community love marriage, Baby Kachma chose to remain quiveringly silent on the subject. The twins were too young to understand all this, so Baby Kachma grudged them their moments of high happiness when a dragonfly they'd caught lifted a small stone off their palms with its legs, or when they had permission to bathe the pigs, or they found an egg hot from a hen. But most of all, she grudged them the comfort they drew from each other. She expected from them some token unhappiness, at the very least. On the way back from the airport, Margaret Kachma would sit in front with Chako because she used to be his wife. Sophie Moore would sit between them. Ammu would move to the back. There would be two flasks of water. Boiled water for Margaret Kachma and Sophie Moore, tap water for everybody else. The luggage would be in the boot. Rahel thought that boot was a lovely word, a much better word at any rate than sturdy. Sturdy was a terrible word, like a dwarf's name. Sturdy Koshi Umman, a pleasant middle-class God-fearing dwarf with low knees and a side parting. On the Plymouth roof rack, there was a four-sided, tin-lined plywood billboard that said, on all four sides, in elaborate writing, Paradise Pickles and Preserves. Below the writing there were painted bottles of mixed fruit jam and hot lime pickle in edible oil, with labels that said, in elaborate writing, Paradise Pickles and Preserves. Next to the bottles there was a list of all the Paradise products and a Kathakali dancer with his face green and skirt swirling. Along the bottom of the S-shaped swirl of his billowing skirt it said, in an S-shaped swirl, Emperors of the Realm of Taste, which was Comrade K&M Pillay's unsolicited contribution. It was a literal translation of Ruji Logatinde Rajava, which sounded a little less ludicrous than Emperors of the Realm of Taste. But since Comrade Pillay had already printed them, no one had the heart to ask him to redo the whole print order. So unhappily, Emperors of the Realm of Taste became a permanent feature on the Paradise Pickle labels. Ammu said that the Kathakali dancer was a red herring and had nothing to do with anything. Chako said that it gave the products a regional flavor and would stand them in good stead when they entered the overseas market. Ammu said that the billboard made them look ridiculous, like a traveling circus with tail fins. Mamachi had started making pickles commercially soon after Papachi retired from government service in Delhi and came to live in Imanam. The Kottayam Bible Society was having a fair and asked Mamachi to make some of her famous banana jam and tender mango pickle. It sold quickly, and Mamachi found that she had more orders than she could cope with. Thrilled with her success, she decided to persist with the pickles and jam and soon found herself busy all year round. Papachi, for his part, was having trouble coping with the ignominy of retirement. He was 17 years older than Mamachi, and realized with a shock that he was an old man when his wife was still in her prime. Though Mamachi had conical corneas and was already practically blind, Papachi would not help her with the pickle making, because he did not consider pickle making a suitable job for a high-ranking ex-government official. He had always been a jealous man, so he greatly resented the attention his wife was suddenly getting. He slouched about the compound in his immaculately tailored suits, weaving sullen circles around mounds of red chilies and freshly powdered yellow turmeric. Watching Mamachi supervise the buying, the weighing, the salting and drying of limes and tender mangoes. Every night he beat her with a brass flower vase. The beatings weren't new. What was new was only the frequency with which they took place. One night, Papachi broke the bowl of Mamachi's violin and threw it in the river. Then Chako came home for a summer vacation from Oxford. He had grown to be a big man and was, in those days, strong from rowing for Balliol. A week after he arrived, he found Papachi beating Mamachi in the study. Chako strode into the room, caught Papachi's vase hand, and twisted it around his back. "I never want this to happen again," he told his father. "Ever." For the rest of that day, Papachi sat in the veranda and stared stonily out at the ornamental garden, ignoring the plates of food that Cocha Maria brought him. Late at night, he went into his study and brought out his favorite mahogany rocking chair. He put it down in the middle of the driveway and smashed it into little bits with a plumber's monkey wrench. He left it there in the moonlight, a heap of varnished wicker and splintered wood. He never touched Mamachi again. But he never spoke to her either as long as he lived. When he needed anything, he used Cocha Maria or Baby Cocha Ma as intermediaries. In the evenings, when he knew visitors were expected, he would sit on the veranda and sew buttons that weren't missing onto his shirts to create the impression that Mamachi neglected him. To some small degree, he did succeed in further corroding Imanam's view of working wives. He bought the sky blue Plymouth from an old Englishman in Munnar. He became a familiar sight in Imanam, coasting importantly down the narrow road in his wide car, looking outwardly elegant, but sweating freely inside his woolen suits. He wouldn't allow Mamachi or anyone else in the family to use it, or even to sit in it. The Plymouth was Papachi's revenge. Papachi had been an imperial entomologist at the Pusa Institute. After independence, when the British left, his designation was changed from Imperial Entomologist to Joint Director Entomology. The year he retired, he had risen to a rank equivalent to Director. His life's greatest setback was not having had the moth that he had discovered named after him. It fell into his drink one evening while he was sitting in the veranda of a rest house after a long day in the field. As he picked it out, he noticed its unusually dense dorsal tufts. He took a closer look. With growing excitement, he mounted it, measured it, and the next morning placed it in the sun for a few hours for the alcohol to evaporate. Then he caught the first train back to Delhi, to taxonomic attention and, he hoped, fame. After 6 unbearable months of anxiety, to Papachi's intense disappointment, he was told that his moth had finally been identified as a slightly unusual race of a well-known species that belonged to the tropical family Limantriidae. The real blow came 12 years later when, as a consequence of a radical taxonomic reshuffle, lepidopterists decided that Papachi's moth was in fact a separate species and genus hitherto unknown to science. By then, of course, Papachi had retired and moved to Imanam. It was too late for him to assert his claim to the discovery. His moth was named after the acting director of the Department of Entomology, a junior officer whom Papachi had always disliked. In the years to come, even though he had been ill-humored long before he discovered the moth, Papachi's moth was held responsible for his black moods and sudden bouts of temper. Its pernicious ghost, gray, furry, with unusually dense dorsal tufts, haunted every house that he ever lived in. It tormented him and his children and his children's children. Until the day he died, even in the stifling Imanam heat, every single day Papachi wore a well-pressed 3-piece suit and his gold pocket watch. On his dressing table, next to his cologne and silver hairbrush, he kept a picture of himself as a young man, with his hair slicked down, taken in a photographer's studio in Vienna, where he had done the 6-month diploma course that had qualified him to apply for the post of Imperial Entomologist. It was during those few months they spent in Vienna that Mamachi took her first lessons on the violin. The lessons were abruptly discontinued when Mamachi's teacher, Launsky Tiefenthal, made the mistake of telling Papachi that his wife was exceptionally talented and, in his opinion, potentially concert class. Mamachi pasted in the family photograph album the clipping from the Indian Express that reported Papachi's death. It said, "Noted entomologist Sri Benan John Ipe, son of late Reverend E. John Ipe of Imanam, popularly known as Punyangunya, suffered a massive heart attack and passed away at the Kottayam General Hospital last night. He developed chest pains around 1.05 a.m. and was rushed to hospital. The end came at 2.45 a.m. Sri Ipe had been keeping indifferent health since last 6 months. He is survived by his wife, Shoshama, and two children." At Papachi's funeral, Mamachi cried and her contact lenses slid around in her eyes. Amu told the twins that Mamachi was crying more because she was used to him than because she loved him. She was used to having him slouching around the pickle factory and was used to being beaten from time to time. Amu said that human beings were creatures of habit, and it was amazing the kind of things they could get used to. "You only had to look around you," Amu said, "to see that beatings with brass vases were the least of them." After the funeral, Mamachi asked Rahel to help her to locate and remove her contact lenses with the little orange pipette that came in its own case. Rahel asked Mamachi whether, after Mamachi died, she could inherit the pipette. Amu took her out of the room and smacked her. "I never want to hear you discussing people's deaths with them again," she said. Esther said Rahel deserved it for being so insensitive. The photograph of Papachi in Vienna, with his hair slicked down, was reframed and put up in the drawing room. He was a photogenic man, dapper and carefully groomed, with a little man's largish head. He had an incipient second chin that would have been emphasized had he looked down or nodded. In the photograph, he had taken care to hold his head high enough to hide his double chin, yet not so high as to appear haughty. His light brown eyes were polite, yet maleficent, as though he was making an effort to be civil to the photographer while plotting to murder his wife. He had a little fleshy knob on the center of his upper lip that drooped down over his lower lip in a sort of effeminate pout, the kind that children who suck their thumbs develop. He had an elongated dimple on his chin, which only served to underline the threat of a lurking manic violence, a sort of contained cruelty. He wore khaki jodhpurs, though he had never ridden a horse in his life. His riding boots reflected the photographer's studio lights. An ivory-handled riding crop lay neatly across his lap. There was a watchful stillness to the photograph that lent an underlying chill to the warm room in which it hung. When he died, Papachi left trunks full of expensive suits and a chocolate box full of cufflinks that Chako distributed among the taxi drivers in Kottayam. They were separated and made into rings and pendants for unmarried daughters' dowries. When the twins asked what cufflinks were for, to link cuffs together, Amu told them, they were thrilled by this morsel of logic in what had so far seemed an illogical language. Cuff plus link equals cufflink. This, to them, rivaled the precision and logic of mathematics. Cufflinks gave them an inordinate, if exaggerated, satisfaction and a real affection for the English language. Amu said that Papachi was an incurable British CCP, which was short for Chichipuch, and in Hindi meant shit wiper. Chako said that the correct word for people like Papachi was Anglophile. He made Rahel and Esther look up Anglophile in the Reader's Digest Great Encyclopedic Dictionary. It said, person well disposed to the English. Then Esther and Rahel had to look up dispose. It said, 1. Place suitably in particular order. 2. Bring mind into certain state. 3. Do what one will with. Get off one's hands. Stow away, demolish, finish, settle, consume, food, kill, sell. Chaco said that in Papachi's case it meant 2. Bring mind into certain state. Which Chaco said meant that Papachi's mind had been brought into a state which made him like the English. Chaco told the twins that though he hated to admit it, they were all Anglophiles. They were a family of Anglophiles. Pointed in the wrong direction, trapped outside their own history and unable to retrace their steps because their footprints had been swept away. He explained to them that history was like an old house at night, with all the lamps lit, and ancestors whispering inside. To understand history, Chaco said, we have to go inside and listen to what they're saying, and look at the books and the pictures on the wall, and smell the smells. Esther and Rahel had no doubt that the house Chaco meant was the house on the other side of the river, in the middle of the abandoned rubber estate where they had never been. Kari Saip's house. The Black Sahib. The Englishman who had gone native. Who spoke Malayalam and wore mundus. Imanam's own Kurtz. Imanam, his private heart of darkness. He had shot himself through the head 10 years ago when his young lover's parents had taken the boy away from him and sent him to school. After the suicide, the property had become the subject of extensive litigation between Kari Saip's cook and his secretary. The house had lain empty for years. Very few people had seen it. But the twins could picture it. The history house. With cool stone floors and dim walls and billowing ship-shaped shadows. Plump, translucent lizards lived behind old pictures, and waxy, crumbling ancestors with tough toenails and breath that smelled of yellow maps gossiped in sibilant, papery whispers. But we can't go in, Chaco explained, because we've been locked out. And when we look in through the windows, all we see are shadows. And when we try and listen, all we hear is a whispering. And we cannot understand the whispering because our minds have been invaded by a war that we have won and lost, the very worst sort of war, a war that captures dreams and re-dreams them, a war that has made us adore our conquerors and despise ourselves. Marry our conquerors is more like it, Amu said dryly, referring to Margaret Kochema. Chaco ignored her. He made the twins look up, despise. It said, to look down upon, to view with contempt, to scorn or disdain. Chaco said that in the context of the war he was talking about, the war of dreams, despise meant all those things. We're prisoners of war. Chaco said. Our dreams have been doctored. We belong nowhere. We sail unanchored on troubled seas. We may never be allowed ashore. Our sorrows will never be sad enough. Our joys never happy enough. Our dreams never big enough. Our lives never important enough. To matter. Then, to give Esther and Rahel a sense of historical perspective, though perspective was something which, in the weeks to follow, Chaco himself would sorely lack, he told them about the Earth Woman. He made them imagine that the Earth, 4,600 million years old, was a 46-year-old woman, as old, say, as Eliyama teacher who gave them Malayalam lessons. It had taken the whole of the Earth Woman's life for the Earth to become what it was. For the oceans to part, for the mountains to rise. The Earth Woman was 11 years old, Chaco said, when the first single-celled organisms appeared. The first animals, creatures like worms and jellyfish, appeared only when she was 40. She was over 45, just 8 months ago, when dinosaurs roamed the Earth. The whole of human civilization as we know it, Chaco told the twins, began only 2 hours ago in the Earth Woman's life, as long as it takes us to drive from Imanam to Cochin. It was an awe-inspiring and humbling thought, Chako said. Humbling was a nice word, Rahel thought. Humbling along without